Hi, thank you for joining the Empowered Relationship Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jessica Higgins, licensed psychologist and relationship coach. In today's episode, we are talking to Gabrielle Utsitinski, and the topic of today's conversation is how increasing love and health can impact borderline personality disorder in relationship. And today's episode is 274. If you would like access to today's show notes, you can visit drjessicahiggins.com, and that's doctor with a DR. There in the top navigation bar, you will see podcast, which will give you access to the podcast page. And again, today's episode is 274. And I'm really thrilled about what the show notes page is offering. It's a beautiful transcript that's user-friendly with highlighted quotes and images, as well as a beautiful summary, time-stamped summary bullet points, and also key takeaways in addition to links mentioned. So I encourage you to check that out. Also on today's show notes, you'll find a free guide, which is shifting criticism into connected communication. And as we're going to be talking about in today's interview, so many of the challenges that occur both individually and within the relationship have so much relevance to the dynamic and the couple's patterns together and the health and the bondedness and the security of those patterns. I'm super excited to be talking with Gabrielle. I feel like she's got such a wealth of insight, understanding, and wisdom to share, particularly as it relates to personality disorders, but also as it relates to couple dynamics. And we're doing something a little different in that she has a YouTube channel, and she had asked for us to be on video so that she could release it on her YouTube channel. So if you're interested in checking out that video, I'll make sure to put a link on today's show notes for you to access that video of our interview and this interview here today. And before we get started, I want to just take a moment and just take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. I like to do this as I invite you to do the same, and I like to set the intention for the Empowered Relationship Podcast. And even in this one breath, I can feel my attention turn inwards. I can feel my physiological body somatically responding to just even that one deep breath. I can feel my attention turn inwards, and I can feel more access to the present moment. And all of these things are useful in practice, particularly when we're thinking about relationship, because so often in a couple dynamic, there's a lot of moving parts, right? You have two individuals and then the space between the relationship. And that's almost like a third entity. And then whatever the content or the interaction involves. And so things can be very fast paced, and we can get caught up, or we could get wrapped up in what we imagine the other person is experiencing, or we could even get hijacked in our own reactivity. And so being able to come back to the breath is such a useful tool to bring awareness to ourselves, to calm the nervous system, to perhaps even be able to discern a little bit more skillfully. And I'm going to turn towards the intention of the Empowered Relationship Podcast, and that is really, in a nutshell, to help you feel better equipped in navigating long-term intimacy, knowing that there will be challenges at times, and helping you be able to use those as opportunities to deepen in your personal growth as well as your relationship growth, all with the intention of helping you cultivate, co-create with your significant other more happiness, more fulfillment, more authenticity, more security, and really just feeling deeply fulfilled in this intimacy that I believe when we cultivate this health and this love and this bond, that it has a ripple effect on everything we do, whether or not it's our line of work or with our families, children, immediate family or extended family, our community, our network, and that if we're feeling that level of safe haven, that we're going to be able to feel that much more supported and confident in the world. And so that's really a bigger vision, but that the real goal of the Empowered Relationship podcast is to support you in navigating the terrain of long-term intimacy, and that oftentimes we're surprised at what might get evoked in this process of cultivating deep, lasting intimacy. And in today's interview, we're really looking at the relationship dynamics and how they can be so healing, even for a personality disorder. So I'm excited to share this interview with you. Let's get started. Gabrielle Utsitinski is a licensed professional counselor and relationship expert in Boulder, Colorado. She is the host of the new TV show, Iconic Couples of History, and the founder of the Power Couples Institute, where she trains therapists worldwide. She has been featured in numerous publications, including Cosmopolitan, Counseling Today, and Women's Health. Her book, The Power Couple Formula, will be released later this year, and she is happily married to her husband, Ted. Gabrielle, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to talk to you about this stuff.
No kidding. And I know you joined us a while back talking about narcissism and the personality features and what to consider. And I'll make sure to put that link on today's show notes so people can have access to that. And today we are looking at borderline personality. And
yes.
I am just interested if we can take a step back looking at personality disorders in general. And for people listening to the Empowered Relationship podcast are really specifically looking at relationship and how should we, could we be looking at personality disorder as it relates to intimate relationship. I know that there are a significant amount of people that are in relationship that are looking at how to navigate challenges and improve the quality of their relationship. And then there are people who are dating that aren't yet deeply committed in this long-term partnership or even marriage. So they're still contemplating, is this person right? And I do think that there are some things to really consider that could be different on either end. So help us with personality disorder, relationship. What would you be wanting us to know to just give us a ground here?
Well, I think a good place to start is just a general orientation to what is a personality disorder, not even borderline personality disorder in particular, but just what is a personality disorder? Because we hear that word so often thrown around in our culture and on YouTube and social media, and we don't often get a sort of a good idea of what we're even really talking about. And that can lead to a lot of stigmas in and of itself. So what we mean by personality disorder as a whole, if we sort of look at, like, because there's a bunch of different personality disorders, right, is that there is a fundamental distortion in the sense of self and also in the sense of other people. It's a sense of fundamental impairment in the way we look at our own identity and the way we look at the identity of others. And what that does is it has a very significant impact both on the person as an individual in terms of their self-esteem, their self-direction in life, just their overall functioning. And we'll talk more about that. But it also has a huge impact on their interpersonal functioning. And as it says in the current idea version of borderline personality disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5, DSM-5, it talks about specifically about the impact on empathy and intimacy. And this is actually the first time that we've had a definition of borderline personality disorder that is the sanctioned definition of what that is in the field of psychology that specifically calls out the impact of personality disorders on empathy and intimacy, which obviously relates directly to a person's ability to be in an intimate relationship.
Yes.
So that's already, like, just as an aside, it's a huge thing that the impact of personality disorders on relationships is now much more clearly recognized, and that we can start to look at that, because for a long time, we were only looking at behaviors, but not so much in terms of the interpersonal impact. So I think it's a huge step forward for us as clinicians to be able to help people with how these personality disorders can negatively impact relationships and what to do about it.
Exactly. And as you said, if someone's searching the web or they're kind of battling or grappling with some conflict in relationship or difficulty and trying to lay person assess almost, it can be easy to, like you said, even put a label and stigmatize it and then even pathologize, which is probably counter to what you would suggest. Because help me with that, what you see with people around, like, I've had this happen, Gabrielle, where people will come into a session and they're like in the beginning and they've got all this stuff that they've gotten off the web and they're like convinced and they're like looking for validation that their partner has this, or, you know, they've already diagnosed each other, so to speak.
I want to get into talking about that. I think in terms of how people can mistype themselves, how people can mistype their partner, and like how to really know accurately what's going on with a partner or with yourself, right? Because this can be a problem with how people see themselves as well, not just their partner, and a lot of misinformation around what this is. So I think perhaps the best way to tackle that question would be actually to just talk a little bit about what borderline personality disorder actually is.
Yes. Can I actually wonder with you just really quickly, because where that question was coming from is if we just put a label and we're looking just at behavior, we're probably missing a large part of the fuller constitution. And you're talking about this inner working, the inside of self,
yes,
and
yes,
also the perception of other. And I think this is honestly everybody in relationship to some degree or another is managing this, what they perceive on the outside of the other and what they're showing on the outside that may be very different than what's going on the inside. And so when we can access the inner layers, there's a deeper understanding and possibly even a way to relate differently that supports those inside mechanisms. So that's kind of where that question came from as you're talking about the DSM-5 and how that is a useful tool for clinicians to have a language around what are we looking at? How are we addressing this? And also looking at people who don't have that training are grappling with the same thing around like, this is how I'm experiencing it and how do I do this? But not just behavior. There's a lot around it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's beautifully put. And I do think that the understanding more the inner life is a really critical ingredient there.
But let's pause on that because you want to help us get the frame. I guess I just was wondering if you felt like if that related to what you were talking about with how we've come with how we're viewing personality disorder.
There is definitely more emphasis on that in our current diagnostic criteria for personality disorders in general and for borderline than there was. I mean, there's a whole history to this.
We could spend the whole episode,
right? Yeah, yeah. But yay that we're really starting to prioritize people's inner experience of themselves and then what they do in relation to their partner, right? But essentially what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a lot of splitting. And splitting is something that people do tend to associate with borderline personality disorder. But in fact, all of the personality disorders use splitting as a defense, you could say, as a coping strategy. It tends to have been most directly connected with borderline, but we actually see it with all the disorders. But let me just say a little bit about that, because I think it'll be really clarifying in terms of what this sort of distinguishing factor is between someone with a personality disorder versus somebody who's just insecure. What happens in the course of maturation as we move through, you know, infancy, childhood, children start out with this split in terms of how they experience their parents. So like mommy, you know, I've got a wet diaper. I cry. Mommy was a little delayed in coming. Bad mommy, right? But this time, you know, now mommy's rocking me and feeding me. That means my experience of mommy is of good mommy, right? So for a very young child, children don't put those two versions of mommy together in their mind into one mommy, right? Who is sometimes good, sometimes bad, but it's the same mommy, you know? But as children grow, they develop that ability to integrate both of those experiences of the parent into a whole. And that's a necessary accomplishment that we need as adults, right? Because let's say we're in an intimate relationship and our partner's having a bad day and they're not treating us, or they're being a little bit cranky or whatever. We need to be able to remember in that moment, oh, you know, he's having a bad day, but I know he loves me. It's just, you know, this thing he has going on at work. But fundamentally, I'm still in contact with the part of him that's loving, where I have good memories of us together. And so it kind of allows me to, in a certain way, it gives me a level of resilience in relationship to just weather the ups and downs of everyday life and how it affects us, right? But the problem with personality disorders in general, but I'd say borderline in particular, is that we don't ever develop that ability to hold both sides of another person and also both sides of ourselves. So we tend to see these incredible kinds of vacillation between, oh, I love you, you're so wonderful, in fact, you're like the best person in the world, you know? And then another day, you know, you did something to upset me and now I hate you and I can't stand you and I never loved you. And so it's this black and white kind of thing, which is the result of this lack of integration, right? This natural process of integration that should happen over the course of development, really by the time we're three years old. So very, very early. There are a number of factors, and I am a big fan of the psychoanalysts and always have been. And of course, the psychoanalysts, starting with Freud, were the ones who originally developed the idea of a personality disorder, you know, that started to see that there were these fundamental problems of a certain kind. And one of my favorite people who comes out of that tradition, James Masterson, says that there are three things that influence a person's personality formation. And those are nature, nurture, and fate. And I like that because I think that just seems to make logical sense, that there are things that happen to us genetically that we come into this world with congenitally, which would be the nature part of it, right? The thing with borderline personality disorder is that we don't actually really know what that is. And there's been a lot of research into this over the last probably 15 years, not just about personality disorders, but attachment in general, how we bond with people, and really trying to find, is there a genetic component to this? And the jury's still out on that. You know, is there a certain neurotransmitter? Is there some sort of thing that we just haven't found that yet? But so the nature part is not that clear. The nurture part is much more clear. I think we have a much better sense of what happens developmentally in early childhood that would account for personality disorders and how that's different from what would produce insecure attachment in a person. And so what we know with what produces borderline personality disorder is there is usually a trauma and abuse and or neglect that is going on in an early childhood relationship, but it is of a specific type. So what happens is at a certain age, very early, 15 to 22 months in general, a baby is starting to become their own person. They're starting to walk and move away from the primary caregiver, the parent, usually the mother, but not always, and explore the world and develop themselves in a certain way, discover things that they're interested in, go after things in the environment that are interesting to them, and so forth. And so with borderline in particular, there's some kind of rupture that happens between the mother and the child at that critical stage where the mother is essentially to put it mildly, not that crazy about the child, the baby becoming their own person.
Mm-hmm.
So these are usually parents who like to keep the child close because it makes them feel well taken care of in a certain way. So it's a way that the child is being used to take care of the emotions of a parent. I like it when you're cute and small and close to me, says mom, because that makes me feel good, makes me feel calmer or better. But as soon as you start to become your own person, I start to feel very insecure. And so I'm going to do things to you that are in some way going to sabotage your natural movement toward what we call self-activation, activating your sense of your real self, going out there, getting what you want. I'm going to sabotage you. And depending on the severity of the disorder, it could be everything from sort of subtly sabotaging you in some way to very, very severe trauma and abuse. So examples of what I might talk about is every time you try and go after that rattle on the floor, you know, every time you walk over and try and get that thing that you're looking for, I start crying as a parent. And the baby sees the mother crying and suddenly they abandon what they have to do and they go back and try to calm the mother. But it could also be that every time you try to become who you are and try something new and go make a friend at the playground, I take you home and I beat you. This is a way that the child is not able to engage in going after their, developing their, in what we call their individuative gifts, their uniqueness, their what makes them a person. And there's insufficient support or just overt obstacles that a parent is putting in the way of that child. And so what happens is it creates a kind of depression in the child. And we call that the abandonment depression. Because every time that child tries to put themselves out there, they feel like the rug is being pulled out from under them. There is no support. They feel horrible about themselves. And they actually start to feel what we know, very specific things. And so we have to fast forward to adulthood here for a moment and look at what happens, how this impacts intimate relationships. Because what this means is that, like, every time you expect something from me or you want me to comfort you, you know, like we're in a relationship, right? And let's say that you, you know, lost your job and you're just down. And I need to step into that role of taking care of you, ministering to you, relieving you, right? All of the things that we see in a securely attached relationship. I can't do that because that starts to trigger my own feeling of abandonment. Like, who's going to do that for me? If I do that for you, who's going to do that for me? Because understand that all of those actions, like we know that caregiving is an essential expression in long-lasting, satisfying, intimate relationships. Adult intimate relationships involve the caregiving system. Both partners need to be able to take turns caring for each other and being cared for by the other person and supporting each other and being supported by the other person. If nobody ever did that for you, or you got punished every time you tried to become your own person, what do you think you're going to do to your intimate partner every time they're trying to become who they are or every time they turn towards you for help?
Well, even in the nervous system, what gets activated, even how the choices that you make, right? And when you're talking about this fast forward, I'm really aware of the repetition and accumulation. It's hard to emphasize how profound this impact is, because we're talking about chronic traumas that are repetitive and habituated, and this sense of, like you said, the lack of safety and potentially injury and trauma that would be incurred through this reaching of self and flexing those muscles, and incredibly hard to access, right? It would be a whole different world. And to be able to even imagine that, one, and then two, to be able to access it, just, it's tremendous.
Yes. And you're pointing to a really important thing when you're talking about sort of this world that's hard to access internally, because in a certain way, that is really the defining differential between somebody just having insecure attachment versus a personality disorder. Because the problem with personality disorders is that people, like, you might do something that is really upsetting, that upsets me. Like, let's say you're sarcastic to me one day, right? And if I'm just a person without a personality disorder, that's going to upset me. But if I'm somebody with a personality disorder, in that moment that you do something upsetting to me, you become my mother, or you become the person who treated me badly in that moment.
And as you mentioned, the distortion, right? The sense of orientation is very skewed, because, as you said, if someone's having that insecure attachment, there's going to be a whole arousal and the physiology and the nervous system. I mean, it's also activating, and the person's going to experience a lot of reaction, but there's still some ability to understand what's at play. But you're talking about a level of perception before that is so skewed based on these traumas. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And what you're pointing to there really is that the neurobiological correlation to what we're talking about, right? Because when you get into an argument with your partner, we know that this activates the deeper brain, right? We are activating the limbic brain and the reptilian brain and these older, deeper brain structures that are all about protecting us from threat. So that's true for all people, that we will feel threatened in our intimate relationship anytime our partner does something that we find threatening. So all people are, regardless of whether you have a personality disorder or not, they fall victim to this phenomenon because it's just part of having a brain, right? It's part of having a mammalian brain, and that we are highly sensitive to threat because we had to always be scanning the environment to see what, if there was anything that could kill us. And that's the same part of the brain that gets activated in our intimate relationships when we feel threatened. So that's true for everybody, right? And everybody loses it. Everybody gets triggered, so to speak, and all of that. But really, the difference with personality disorders is there's just far less ability to step back from that experience of being triggered, even after the fact, when everyone's calmed down, and say, you know what? I know you're not my mother. It just got me. You just got me there. That really reminded me of what she used to do to me. That's the observing function of the brain, right? And that's the neocortex, the big cauliflower-shaped part of the brain that has the ability to reflect on these deeper, more animalistic experiences of trigger and emotion that we have and go, you know, I know that that's how that felt, but I know that that's not really who you are. People with personality disorders tend to have a much less active neocortex that has that in terms of the specific reflective function. I'm not saying they're not, you know, intellectually brilliant and they don't have great executive functioning. They might have all of those things, but we're really talking about social emotional capacities here. And we're talking about that ability to kind of manage and mitigate those raw kinds of emotions and physiological experiences that arise. So it's a lack of neural integration, you could say.
Which probably relates very closely to what you were talking about around identifying with the difficulty with empathy and interpersonal relating.
Yes, yes, very much so, right? And so we are talking about, you know, the psychoanalysts really before we had neuroscience, they had a more psychological understanding of these deficits. And, you know, again, we don't want to pathologize people. We don't want to make people with personality disorders bad, although it's extremely easy to do that. And that's what our culture does, right? But we want to look at this. I find like it's just more helpful to look at these issues more in the context of a spectrum, where everyone is sort of on a spectrum somewhere, because the fact of the matter is, as Dr. Stan Tadkin says, we all have things that our brains do well and things that our brains don't do well. And it's just that in the case of personality disorders, there tends to be a higher number of things that the person's brain doesn't do well and that create more distress unless they are properly treated and addressed, right? But just from a psychoanalytic perspective, we're talking about things when it comes to personality disorders, and borderline is included in that. We're talking about things like not really being able to, what they call poor reality testing. It's a difficulty in kind of perceiving what's happening in a way that's actually based in reality. Now, I know we all do that, obviously, but with personality disorders, this can look incredibly extreme, because of that loss of connection to, I know that you're not really that person who hurt me, right? So let's say we go to a party, you know, and we're in therapy, and we went to this party, and I'm telling you that at the party, you told me that you wanted me to make out with your best friend's wife, and you sat there and watched while I made out with your best friend's wife, okay, because that's what you wanted me to do. And then, you know, in investigating that and talking about it further with the person who said that, the partner who said that, and the other partner, it turns out that that actually never happened. Hmm. And this person who accused the other partner of doing that confirms this never happened. Actually, you know what? That's actually not what happened at all. It was consensual. We all decided together that we were going to have this group sexual experience, okay? Because this is a big thing now, you know, polyamory is a big thing. Group sex is on a lot of people's minds. A lot of couples are making decisions to open up their relationship, bring in other people, experiment with having sexual experiences with other couples, and so forth, right? But people start, you know, somebody says, you know, you told me you forced me to do that, and I had nothing to do with it. I never agreed to do that. But in discussing it further, you find out, actually, no, that's not true. This was totally agreed to, and there was nothing that was coerced, and so forth. So I'm trying to give you an example of how totally skewed something can be. Like, it's not a small misunderstanding or a small misperception. It's a radical misperception, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a good example, an extreme example of poor reality testing. It's kind of just turning you on your head. Like, what?
I love the description of the spectrum, because I do understand research helps us that even the average person remembers incorrectly or perceives inaccurately when they're heightened or threatened, like you said, and that this is a very different experience and that the whole reality is skewed.
Right.
And okay. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I feel like we could do a whole summit with you, Gabrielle. The wealth of knowledge is profound, and I am so encaptured. And I can just say for myself, as you talk about those early years and the sabotage or potentially even abuse, like my heart and the compassion. And also, as I put my mind into a listener's space where they're potentially in relationship with someone who has a personality disorder or borderline, there can be a lot of compassion once there's an understanding around what this individual experienced. But as you said, there's so much splitting and distortion. Like, my suspicion is that A, they don't even have access to all the trauma and the understanding. So the compassion is limited because potentially it's not visible, right? Because mm-hmm. that's the deeper inside, very vulnerable, that's not always visible. And then secondly, if the person has some inkling of it and is compassionate, there's a limit around, well, how do I interact, right, with the deficit that we're talking about with empathy and interpersonal. How does someone manage, like, if I'm confronting these conflicts or these accusations or these behaviors that I want to feel healthy and safe in relationship with you?
There's something for me that I feel I want to get across on this call, because I think it's so important, which is sort of like a pre-question to the questions that you're asking right now, which is that people very often mistype themselves and their partner. Really understanding the nature of the problem when it comes to social emotional problems in relationship, when it comes to mental health of individuals, is actually a very complex, sophisticated domain that requires clinical training to accurately assess what is going on is extremely challenging. And any clinician who doesn't recognize how hard it really is to accurately identify the problem that a couple is having isn't in touch with the scope of the endeavor. The thing is, even clinicians very often misdiagnose borderline personality disorder specifically. It gets mistaken for bipolar disorder a lot. It gets mistaken for dissociative identity disorder a lot. And it gets mapped onto women way more than it does men. It has a sort of a cultural stigma that this is a female disorder. And so a lot of clinicians turn off their radar for it when they're working with a male client, because we're just culturally, it's because it involves so much emotionality. We tend to associate emotionality with women because culturally men are not supported in being emotional, right? So men tend to get lumped into having anger management problems, impulse control problems. Women, oh, it's borderline personality disorder. Okay. So those are some of the, I'm trying to give you examples of some of the obstacles that come up, even for clinicians, when really trying to understand what's going on. But here's the thing. A very common scenario that happens in couples therapy is that couples come in, and this is often a gendered scenario, so I'm just going to present it that way, is that the female is being viewed by the male partner as having borderline personality disorder. I mean, I have to be honest, I've never seen a couple where the woman came in saying, I believe my husband has borderline personality disorder, but the other way around all the time. Mm-hmm. So the couple's coming in, the man is convinced, and I'm talking about heterosexual couples, but this could also apply to non-heterosexual couples, but we're just going to talk about heterosexual for the sake of convenience here, where the man is saying, I'm convinced that my wife meets all the criteria for borderline. She's so irrational. She gets upset at the smallest thing. She's calling me all the time at work and like is just acting like a crazy person. She's crying all the time and so on and so forth, right? And what we see when we start to investigate that relationship is that this woman is being deeply neglected by her husband. Her husband sleeps in his own wing of the house. He's on the road most of the time. And when he is home, he is critical of her. He's a name caller. He is devaluing her. But none of that is seen on the surface, because all of that happens behind closed doors. Mm. And he looks cool as a cucumber on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
But she, on the other hand, is the one who's totally over the top emotional, starts crying at the drop of a hat in a therapist's office. Clearly unreasonable, right? So this perception that you've got this crazy person here with this other person who's totally got it together is absolutely false. And that is usually false. And the mm-hmm. reason is because we know that developmentally, people tend to choose partners who are at a similar sort of developmental level psychologically that they are. So we don't tend to pick somebody who is so much more sort of psychologically developed than we are. We tend to be more sort of close to each other than not. And so part of what we need to look at is, are there any legitimate claims to what this person who we're saying the partner's saying this person has borderline personality disorder? Okay, but they have concerns about what their partner is doing. And the first order of business is to look at, is there any legitimacy to that? Because the thing with borderlines is that they're not out of touch. Even though I talked about poor reality testing, on another level, they see things with incredible accuracy, but the problem is they're hypersensitive to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you were sarcastic to me, and now you're like the biggest ogre in the world. Okay, but you were still sarcastic to me. That's still a problem. And so we need to deal with those things first at face value and take all of those threats off the table, get this partner of the borderline person to start behaving in a loving way toward their partner, move toward their partner, do nice things for their partner. And at that point, we can actually start to go after the borderline personality disorder. We can't even really address that if the person with borderline has legitimate concerns about how they're being treated in the relationship, they're being neglected, they're being emotionally abused, we've got to deal with that.
Gabrielle, I love your emphasizing this. This is so important in my experience. Just again, couples across the board will come in and they're often consciously or even unconsciously or subconsciously really looking for validation that like, I'm right, you're the jerk. You know what I mean? And so I know we're talking about something different when we're talking about personality disorder, but the same kind of quality is there, the pathologizing or you're wrong or the pointing fingers. And if we can really work with the dynamic, creating that safety, creating that loving kindness, but also the stability where we're really able to reveal more of those insides, the vulnerability, and having that connection, then it becomes so much more visible to work with. Where do you go? Where do you go in your mind? Where do you go emotionally? Like what happens when this, like, and then there's the safety to really look at that. And then that becomes so much more visible and then perhaps even safe to even explore and treat or work with.
Beautiful. Yeah. Because what happens, we know what's going to happen when we have this partner. And here, let me also say, you know that borderlines often pair with people who are on the narcissistic spectrum, who either have narcissistic personality disorder or they have narcissistic traits, or at the very least, they're avoidantly attached. Okay.
Yeah.
So we have this kind of common pairing where you have one person who the avoidant or slash narcissist slash person with narcissistic traits tends to be on the distancer type of character, distancing, needs their personal space, experiences a high level of interpersonal stress. So they tend to keep to themselves, not invest in the relationship. And then this borderline person who is on the anxious attachment spectrum, because borderlines are anxiously attached.
It's that hypersensitivity.
Yes, right. So borderline is, you could say from an attachment perspective, it's an extreme version of anxious attachment. Narcissistic personality disorder is an extreme version of avoidant attachment, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So you have this person who is the pursuer, who needs the contact, who needs the reassurance, right? So perfect storm. This is a perfect storm. So when we start to actually move this avoidant person toward the borderline partner and get them to do nice things for them, what this borderline person is going to do is they're going to try and bite their head off. They're going to try and kill them. They're going to spit in their face, fight back, or
test.
Or if they're slightly more high functioning, they might say, I don't deserve this. Okay, I don't deserve this love, but that would be a higher functioning character. But the point is, they're going to try to reject in some way. They're going to try and sabotage that love.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember that conversation about how they were sabotaged as children? They're going to try and sabotage the very thing that they need the most, which is the love and security from their partner. That's the point, clinically, where we can start to confront this borderline person as to why they would do that. And this was Masterson's great invention. Why would you throw away the very thing that you need the most? You're here because you say you want to create a loving, intimate relationship. And yet when it's sitting right here on your doorstep, you crap all over it. Why? So what we're doing there is we are getting them to do the work around holding up what Masterson calls juxtaposing two contrasting sides of an issue. So you're saying you want this love, but then when it's here, you destroy it,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the borderline conflict, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But how could we possibly even look at that until the love is forthcoming? We mm-hmm. can't even deal with that, right? Because for most couples, the borderline has a point. We right. are not being treated well. So how can you blame them for being upset? You see?
Right. No, and precisely this is such a important illustration of how complex and important and even critical it is to get the right support, the trained eye to be able to assist in what you're describing.
Right.
If someone's noticing the dynamic and it feeling really challenging, mm-hmm. perhaps having compassion on one side, but then also really like, I don't know how to create health in this system by myself. And maybe commitment level doesn't really matter that much, because if somebody is invested in the person, then they might want to explore how to do the dynamics differently and get support from you to unpack that. But I guess I was curious, is there any place that you would advise, like how somebody to take care of themselves that might be in relationship to someone who has a borderline personality? I mean, would you always recommend getting support to deepen in the health and the system of the relationship?
Well, as I'm saying, if you're in love with somebody and you suspect that this person has borderline personality disorder, I would suggest the first thing to do is to go to couples therapy with somebody who is trained, who understands personality disorders and specifically how to work with them in couples therapy.
Yes.
And so I would have a third
party. Underscore.
Yes. I would have a third party, meaning the therapist,
yes,
observe the relationship in real time.
Yes.
Because the starting point for dealing with borderline is this couple taking excellent care of each other?
Mm-hmm.
Are you taking excellent care of your partner who you think has borderline personality disorder? Usually the answer, even from the person, is no. Even right. They'll say, you know, I wouldn't say it's excellent.
Right, because people typically react to each other. You were a jerk and I'm now huffy and stymie and gonna
Well, and then that's sort of implying that the borderline is the one starting that, but it's not necessarily true. And that's the problem, is passive aggressiveness in the other partner can be very difficult to see on the surface, because a lot of these behaviors are subversive and they're more subtle than what's going on with the borderline. So all of that has to be examined by a professional who can say, look what just happened here.
Yes.
When
Gabrielle, there's never really always a beginning and an end. I do want to say, like, my model of like really that infinity, just how we're reacting to each other.
Exactly. So, right.
Okay.
We're talking about the, so in other words, we're addressing the system, because it takes two to tango. Both people are playing a role. Now, if we've been through all of that and we've really looked at that and we've really gotten this partner to do something loving for this other partner, right? And what we see is that this partner is continuing to act out, continuing to call all day, continuing to act in destructive ways, lying to the partner, engaging in self-injurious behavior, self-harming behavior, suicide attempts, stealing, all kinds of self-harm, right? And this is out of control behavior. Then we have to look at more intensive forms of treatment. And there are, I'm not trying to say that couples therapy is the be all and end all for dealing with borderline personality disorder, far from it. But I am saying that a lot of these relationship dynamics, when we get them sorted out, this borderline person doesn't look so borderline anymore. And it's really important to know that people change and they will no longer meet the diagnosis, even if they did, once we sort out the relationship. And we help this couple create a relationship that's based on principles like equality, like empathy, like fairness, and lots of affection every day, lots of gratitude, praise for each other every day, dealing with each other's distress, all of these things that we know from the research couples need to be able to do in order for their nervous systems to calm down and for them to be relaxed with each other and engage in a loving, mutualistic relationship. So that has to be, as far as I'm concerned, paramount. And there's plenty of research to support couples therapy as a way of dealing with borderline personality disorder. So that would be, for me, first order of business. But if you're still dealing with issues, there are times that somebody will need a certain kind of intensive treatment. And sometimes that is intensive outpatient treatment where they're attending a program for a number of weeks in a psychiatric type of hospital where they're in group therapy. They might be in individual therapy. There are check-ins every day. So individual treatment could be important with really, really out of control types of behavior, right?
Well, and I would wonder, Gabrielle, too, that with this secure functioning relationship and this relaxed comfort of being able to care for each other in this reciprocity, that it would make that individual work much more supported and doable, even, right? That resilience of having that relationship that supports some of those inner self perception and outer, that to really confront some of that. What would you say?
100%. And there are times that those things can work incredibly well together. Because we can't take people out of the systems in which they reside, polish them up, and then expect that they're going to function like that in their system, because we are part of the systems and the systems are us. The self is so much more a derivative of the system. Mm-hmm. The relationship is really what's primary. That's how I look at it, because I'm...
Yes. And I'm curious, I know how much research there is, even as you talk about attachment, when we can earn a secure attachment in adulthood, that can actually have such a healing impact on our working model internally. Do you feel that that's also true, that the system, the health of the couple and the functioning can actually support the healing for the individual that might have traits of borderline? Or, I mean, I'm not saying they don't need treatment, but do you find that being healing?
Yes, that is so much a part of how I think about these things. And there is so much support for that. And because, as I said, people can meet the criteria for borderline personality disorder, go into couples therapy. And if the therapy has been done appropriately, the person's no longer meeting the criteria. So we see how the relationship has a direct impact on the self. And we tend to undervalue the fact of that because we are such an individual-centric society. We're so focused on individual development, individual striving. It's all very focused on the self. And our culture has been going in the wrong direction with that for a very long time.
I know. Even my question, as I'm reflecting, as I asked my question and we were talking, my question became less relevant.
Oh,
right? Because I was asking, well, if I'm putting myself in the position of a listener who's wondering about a significant other that has personality disorder and how they might be compassionate and also how do they take care of themselves, right? And you're saying, if we really look at the system and the functioning, and if there's a love and there's being in love with someone, that there's that draw, can we address the system and can that be the focus and the health around that? And it starts to take care of itself.
Yes, that's right. Because the system, you can do things with the system that you actually are much harder to do with the individuals within the system. Mm-hmm. You can talk to the whole system and reflect how you guys are not taking care of each other. You know, you could talk to people about their behavior in a way that is a lot more difficult when you're just talking to one person, because they're more likely to take it personally. Yeah.
And when you have the third party, like trained like yourself and myself with couples, I would not say I'm an expert by any means on the, I mean, look, I have a master's and a PhD and I understand personality disorder. I understand the functionality, but I would nowhere near say that I am an expert or even I would refer out. So I would say the average clinician does not get a ton of training in personality and how to treat unless you really have geared your work towards that. And the work around couple dynamic and the experiential, when you have that third party, I think that you have an impact to change the system, even when you are talking to one person and the significant other's witness to that and the work that's happening, that's changing the system experientially. And then how, yeah, there's so much here. Okay, Gabrielle, I know we could wrap for like hours and yep. I love what you have to offer. And I just, you know, I know I had you on the show before, but I just continue to feel so much in support of what you're doing and your outlook and your methodology. Is there anything else you want to say about borderline personality and relationship? I know we've scratched the surface, and then I want to transition to how do people get in touch with you and what you're up to?
One of the very most important things to think about, regardless of what stage you're at, whether you're just dating, starting out dating, or even thinking about dating, or you've been married for 25 years and you think your partner might have a borderline personality disorder, is about the kind of relationship that you want to have. What kind of relationship do you want to have if you're single? And if you're not single and you're in a relationship, what kind of relationship do we want to have? Because every system, every across time, in order for systems in general to function at a high level, they need to have some kind of organizing principle that guides their behavior in the system. If you look at all of the religious traditions, the monastic systems all had moral codes. You know, you could say we're not so crazy about the idea of moral code these days, but the if you look at high functioning business organizations, they all have some sort of motto or some kind of mission statement, mm-hmm. right? Steve Covey, who talks about the family mission statement, couples need a mission statement. They need a why. Dave Logan, in his book, Tribal Leadership, why be an organization? And that's a question that if you don't answer that as a couple, then you are invariably going to run into problems. Because whether we're borderline or not, some days we wake up and we feel lots of love for our partner and we feel like just being the most generous, loving person in the world. And other days we wake up and, you know, not so much. You're just kind of pissing me off. I'm in a bad mood. I don't really feel like being loving today. So why should I? And so relationships have to be about holding each other in, that we have a reason that we agree to. And this is what we're going to do for each other at the worst of times, not just when we feel like it. And so if you have that orientation, you can be as crazy as you might think you are, but you're still being held accountable for your behavior, just like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't roll with that, then the relationship's done. Because when people break the rules too many times, the relationship simply will not stand. It doesn't make sense for people to be in a relationship unless it is seriously improving the quality of their lives in some way, right?
Yes.
So.
Beautiful. I love it. Okay. And Gabrielle, how do people get in contact with you? What you're up to? What are you offering?
Well, I have my clinical practice in Colorado, but I have a number of other things going on. I'm writing a book right now. It's going to be out at the end of this year. It's called The Power Couple Formula. And people can go to thepowercoupleformula.com and sign up to get weekly relationship advice for free delivered to your inbox and just to stay connected until the book comes out. And they can go to powercouplseducation.com, which is my educational business for lay people, for the general public. And I have a YouTube channel, Power Couples Education is the name of it. So you can go visit that as well. And I've got my Institute for Training, the training of therapists, which is the Power Couples Institute. And that would be more for clinicians. So those are lots of ways to get in touch with me.
I actually know I have several clinicians that listen to the show. And so I hope that if people are resonating with what you're offering, whether or not is to continue their professional training or to assist in their couple dynamic and just the wealth of information you have to share, I will make sure to have these links that you're mentioning right now on today's show notes.
Yes.
And so that's all accessible in your book and your group and your forum and your education. And it sounds like you also do coaching as well. And it's just tremendous.
Actually, unfortunately, I don't do coaching.
Oh, you don't do coaching. You the therapy
therapy online with people who are within the state of Colorado.
Gotcha.
That would be. I forgot to mention one other important thing is that I just got signed to my own TV show about relationships. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. It's a Canadian television company, but it will be available on Amazon Prime when it's ready. And it is about couples, power couples across history.
We're
taking a deep dive into looking at famous and infamous relationships of couples over time.
Fun.
Anthony and Cleopatra to, you know, the Obamas and everything in between kind of thing. And what made, you know, did their relationship work? If so, why not? What are the principles at play there? And what modern couples can take away from that? So I'm very excited about that as well.
Oh, wow. Keep us posted. Yeah. I would love to support the show and watch it myself.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you have enjoyed today's interview, again with Gabrielle Utsatinsky. And again, if you would like access to links mentioned or perhaps even to her YouTube channel, you can check out today's show notes, which can be found on my website, which is drjessicahiggins.com. Click on podcast, and there you'll find all of the episodes. And again, today's episode is 274, how increasing relationship love and health can impact borderline personality disorder. And also, you'll find a free guide on the show notes page. You'll also see many free gifts on the website. But the one that I'm referring to is the Shifting Criticism into Connected Communication. And this does really relate to the health and love relating in relationship, that when we get off track, it can be very common to point out, to call out or criticize, critique our partner. And that tends to lend towards that defensive response that then gets us into perhaps even escalating and basically calling each other out and who's right, who's wrong. And it really diverts from the deeper, important point, which is like, this is hard for me, I'm struggling, or I need your support, and really feeling like we can attune to that and connect with that. So whether or not we're wanting our partner to really hear our deeper longing, or whether or not we are responding to our partner's deeper request, and how critical that is in feeling really connected and working together. I encourage you to check that out. It's a side-by-side comparison of giving you examples of language and really helping you deconstruct what the critical tendency looks like and what it involves, as well as what a more constructive request or a constructive solicit to your partner will look like. And again, helping you have some real nuts and bolts around how to do that. And again, you can find that on today's show notes page, which can be found on my website, drjessicahiggins.com, and that's doctor with a DR. Thank you so much for listening and spending your valuable time exploring relationship principles on the Empowered Relationship podcast. And until next time, I hope you take great care.
You've been listening to Empowered Relationship, your relationship guide. Remember to take a moment to write a review and subscribe today. You can also get your free relationship gift by visiting drjessicahiggins.com.